Welcome back to The Roundtable. I'm Ian Pickus. From time to time, we check in with Andrew Gooley, editor of The Strand magazine, usually after he's uncovered a sliver of lost literary history. And this time, it's a play co-written by J.M. Barrie of Peter Pan fame. The reconstruction of the crime, a sensational scene, is published in the latest issue. It's a bit of a send-up of the mystery genre that fills the rest of The Strand's pages. Andrew Gooley, welcome back to The Roundtable.
Thanks a lot, Ian. Good to be here.
So tell us a little bit about this short play.
Well, it has a lot of the elements of a spoof, a bedroom farce. Plus, there's this little sneaky little poke at the mystery genre. It's, in many respects, J.M. Barrie was a very, very good satirist. And in this play, you know, it's titled The Reconstruction of the Crime, and you know, that makes you conjures up images of, you know, some blood being shed and a murder. But there is no murder and there is no blood. But there are just some very, very self-important, very dramatic people who are exaggerating a lot of things that happen in a hotel with some bedrooms being switched.
Who was the co-author, E.V. Lucas?
E.V. Lucas, in his time, was a very, very well-known man of letters. He wrote hundreds of articles for Punch, was a very, very well-known humorist, was a translator, was a scholar. He was a prolific man and a very, very good friend of J.M. Barrie. The interesting side note about this is that there's never been a record of them collaborating before with each other, and this is the first time that they had done so. But I can't say that anything went south with these two guys because they remained lifelong friends. So they might have collaborated on this, and then either one of them maybe found something else that took up their time, and they probably lost focus. But they were, by all accounts, wonderful, wonderful, wonderful friends.
What year are we talking about when this was written?
Well, I've spoken to a couple of scholars, and as I always tell you, I'm not a scholar. I'm a publisher, and I admire people who can just be focused on one particular subject. So I spoke to the four people who were, you know, who've made J.M. Barrie their life's work. And I've had a couple of estimates. One person said 1912. One person said 1919. So they're all of them can agree that it was written between 1912 and 1919. And that was a period where Barrie was at times writing some very, very quick plays, but he was more focused on plays that had a social message. A lot of times we look at Peter Pan and we think that Barrie's this, like, very, very, you know, funny type of a guy, but he also tackled a lot of very, very interesting issues in his plays that were not the seemingly lighthearted plays that are appreciated by adults and children.
And how was this particular play discovered? I understand it was in the archives in Texas?
Exactly. Well, how this came about was something which can be described as probably something a little comical, and I think J.M. Barrie would have appreciated this all, because I found it last year, and I was working with some Barrie scholars, and they were saying, oh, they've never heard of this, and we're going back and forth with them, and a lot of Barrie scholars are very, very interested in the whole Peter Pan phenomenon. So some people had the attitude of, well, I don't know, I might have been performed, but, you know, we just know a lot about Peter Pan. So when I was reasonably confident that I had clearance from a few good scholars, I was ready to publish this this February. And I ended up getting the type of email that every editor dreads when my intrepid copy editor contacted me and he said, Andrew, there's a play that premiered in London in 1917, 100 years to the day when he had sent me this email, and it was called Reconstructing the Crime. he asked, "Are you comfortable publishing something with a title that's very, very close to what you're publishing?"
Uh-oh.
And I said, "I am not comfortable with that, and I think my month has been ruined." So we had to immediately pull that off, remove it from the magazine, put something else in, and that, of course, caused a bit of a delay, and it was a bit of a logistical nightmare to try to put something in the magazine in the last minute and then remove something that we had planned on, we're working on a marketing plan for. So in the meantime, I just said to myself, I need to find a copy of the play that he had mentioned, the one that premiered in 1917. So I contacted Mary Ellen Budney at the Beinecke Library in Yale University. And I said, "Mary Ellen, I really need your help. I need to see this play as soon as possible." So this was, a few weeks after we went to press. And she'd sent me a copy of the play, and it was 100% different from the play that we found in the University of Texas. So, there are contrasting moments of this story, an extreme low and an extreme feeling of like, yeah, we can finally publish this.
Wow. Oh, long and tortured road to print.
Exactly, exactly. As I said, I think Barry would have appreciated the irony of this thing where, you have this person who's just like really pumping his fist in the air and very, very happy and just completely dejected, almost looking like a caricature of a disappointed person.
To your knowledge, was it ever performed?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, there's a lot of very, very good scholarship on Barry. In fact, about all the plays that were performed, and some of the scholars are detailed to the point where you can see if a play was performed on just one occasion. And the definitive scholar who wrote a book about Barry's biography, Dennis McHale, he makes no mention of it. And a few of the other scholars I've spoken to, they seem very, very confident that this never, ever, ever was performed.
Huh. Reading it, I got the sense that it was somewhat of a ancestor of dinner theater, mystery dinner theater that we have today.
It does seem like that. And another interesting, you brought up a very good point, because it has that whole feeling of audience participation. And we all can remember when Peter Pan asked the audience if they believe in fairies, and if they said that they would, Tinkerbell would be saved, and if they said that they did not, Tinkerbell would die. And Barry was very, very good at trying to have his audience interact with his actors and with the plays that he had written. And it does have that whole feel of this dinner theater type play, something that's very lighthearted, but at the end has this... is poking fun at the mystery genre. And we all know that J.M. Barrie was very, very good friends with Arthur Conan Doyle, the creator of Sherlock Holmes. And he wrote one of the first Sherlock Holmes spoofs in the 1890s. So, this might have been a little bit of a wink at his good friend Arthur Conan Doyle, who was also a fellow Scotsman.
As the editor of a mystery magazine, a quarterly, do you like spoofs of the genre, or do you get your hackles up a little bit?
Initially, when we first published the magazine, we had we were just averse to trying to do any spoof or anything that was a Sherlock Holmes pastiche. And a lot of bookstores and people we spoke to said, if you do this, then we will order the magazine. And I said to myself, okay, it's not like new magazines aren't entirely, becoming this big, big, big thing. So I'm going to do this and see what people think of this, because I could not afford to tell a bunch of very important people that were just going to become strictly very literary or just strictly very genre. And a couple of years down the line, I just looked and I said to myself, after reading some very, very good spoofs and pastiches of great authors, that they had a lot of value in that they were just, if it was a pastiche of an author, it was bringing their work back to life. but in a way for a modern audience to appreciate. I mean, if I, for example, read the Mr. Ripley books by Patricia Highsmith, I've said to myself, oh, wow, yeah, Ripley is not a character who I'd like as my next-door neighbor, but I would like to read more of his adventures. And if it's handled by a writer who's very, very skillful, it can extend a character, it can extend the type of a writing style that were not for some modern writers would just perish along the way, and you would never, ever read a Sherlock Holmes story, but you'd have those, you know, scores of stories that Doyle wrote, but that just would be it. So I do love spoofs and satires. I've not been a convert for a very long time, probably 15 out of 19 years of editing the magazine, but I do think they have a valuable place in the canon.
Okay, Andrew, like I always end our talks, give us a cliffhanger. What's coming up next?
Well, next we have something good, but in the summer of next year, it's going to be something that's going to be really, really, really big.
That's it? That's all you'll give us?
Oh, because if I give you guys a clue, then we'll know, and the contract has not been signed yet, so.
Okay, well, I'm going to put you on the calendar. We'll check in a little while, and once the news is out, we will celebrate another rediscovered piece of literary history.
Excellent. Well, this piece is not exactly rediscovered. It's been known about, but there has not been an opportunity to publish it, and we finally have gotten that, so we're very excited about that. I think I gave you a little clue, just enough to get into trouble.
We've been speaking with Andrew Gooley, editor of The Strand magazine, and Andrew, it's always a pleasure to get a chance to catch up with you and see what's coming up in the magazine, so thanks so much for being with us.
Excellent. Thanks a lot, Ian. Always a pleasure, and I look forward to speaking with you soon.
And you're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.